In his new book, Rediscovering Values, Jim Wallace argues that the worst thing we can do now is get back to normal. Normal is what got us into this mess in the first place. We need a new normal. And this economic crisis is perhaps an invitation, an opportunity to discover what that means. And some of the principles he unpacks for a new normal are spending money we don't have for things we don't need is a bad foundation for a family and for an economy. Care for the poor is not just a moral duty, it's critical for the common good. And finally, a healthy society is a balanced society in which markets, the government, and communities all play a role. Jim Wallace is president and CEO of Sojourners, where he is editor-in-chief of Sojourners magazine. He's taught at Harvard's Divinity School and Kennedy School of Government on faith, politics, and society. He's written 8 books, including God's Politics, The Great Awakening, The Soul of Politics, and his newest, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. And you can learn more about all of this, the magazine, his work, the tour, at soho.net. That's SOJO.net. Welcome again, Jim Wallace.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, Jim. Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So before we delve into some of these issues, tell us a bit, probably a story you've told many times, but about your path to the kind of work you do today.
My path, okay. I was raised in Detroit, where I started the book tour this week, in fact. It was counterintuitive to begin a book tour in what publishers would say is one of the worst book cities in the country. But Simon Schuster gave out free books in Detroit, which
was
pretty cool. I was raised there, and basically the polarization of Detroit, I asked how come we live the way we do in white Detroit, and life seems so different in black Detroit. I was about 14 or 15, I began to ask those questions, and I always tell young people, follow your questions, and trust your questions, and see where they lead you. And mine led me into the inner city, which I had never known before, and the black churches, which they... They read the same Bible and loved the same Jesus, and they sang out of the same hymn book that made it sound much better than we did. And I brought my answers and friends back to my church, and neither were welcome. So I got kicked out of my old church as a teenager and found my home in the civil rights and anti-war movements of my time, and then came back to my faith, but a different faith. I went to seminary and began Sojourners, and trying to understand how faith is personal and public at the same time. And this new book is an attempt to look at the deeper issues underlying the economic crisis, the values crisis that we need to start talking about.
Very good. Thank you for doing that. You know, I looked up you on Wikipedia, and here's just something I'd never heard before that I want to ask you about. On Wikipedia, it says that you headed Students for Democratic Society when you were at Michigan State. Truth and or... Where does that fit in your past?
Well, I was at Michigan State, but there was no SDS chapter. I was in Michigan. But I was the student. I was on the student, in 1970, the student strike coordinating committee that got elected to run that strike after Cambodia and Kent State. So
sure.
SDS was down the road. We at Michigan State had a similar thing, but it wasn't SDS per se.
Okay. So this tour that you talked about.
Uh-huh.
Let's jump right into this. In other words, one thing I notice as I look at the materials on your website, the daily blogging you're doing, is that this, I think, to you, is more than just a tour to promote a new book.
Well, I wrote the book because I think we need a new conversation. Underneath this economic crisis, there's a discussion I think America really wants to have. And frankly, after the first week, I'm convinced we want to have it. And in Detroit, it was a very cold day. The first day back after vacation, the organizers were really nervous about the turnout. We had 500 people turn up.
Oh, great.
And they were like, from economists and academics to community organizers, pastors, poverty workers, and ordinary folks. And so in New York Riverside Church, we had the same thing. And I think people are ready for a conversation, even though the news cycle, I said, I'm sorry I didn't write a chapter on airport security and one on Tiger Woods, which would have been more exciting for this week. But the news cycle was all about airport security, but we had these great town meetings in we're going to about 16 cities and having the same thing. So I think it's a conversation that is, and if we don't have this, all the pain and suffering in my hometown of Detroit and so many other places will have been in vain. So the only way to redeem this crisis is to not go back to business as usual, but to say, what does a new normal look like now?
Right. I couldn't agree with you more that this crisis, in some sense, brought to a head, brought to a crash, some of the things that I know you've been talking about for years, we've been talking about on the show, this station, this network for years. Do you see the possibility of this crisis really changing things? And let me just say that, if you look, as I'm sure we're all doing, at what's happening in Washington and Wall Street, or Washington in relationship to Wall Street, it doesn't look nearly enough to me that we are getting a new enough normal.
Well, that's right. But the subtitle says on Wall Street, Main Street, and your street. So the learnings so far have been more on Main Street than Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I have three chapters. One's called Greed is Good. The other is It's All About Me. And the third is I Want It Now. These are maxims that wreck economies, families, cultures, and frankly, our souls. And they've taken over. And contrasting those, I have three other old virtue chapters saying enough is enough. We're in this together. And I love the Native American notion. I call it the seventh generation mindset. You evaluate decisions today by their impact on the seventh generation out. Now, that's a whole new kind of learning about new habits of the heart. I think that's the country. There's a new sense of building community in Detroit, for example. Maybe in Michigan and Ohio, a place like that, where all you have left is hope, that will be where the new things break out first. But the Capuchin Fathers have given hundreds of thousands of plants, and a whole movement has grown there about community gardens, healthy food, good food, work for unemployed people, and building community. Instead of keeping up with the Joneses, why not look out for the Joneses, see if they're okay?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of that's going on. A piece in the New York Times last week, people are doing more and buying less. I'm a Little League baseball coach for my 6-year-old and my 11-year-old, and I see a lot of stuff happening, rethinking things there. Now, on Wall Street, on the other hand,
yeah,
they seem to have learned almost nothing. So the question is, how do we help them wake up a bit? And so in the book, and I did a piece for the Post last week about this, I'm suggesting we look at things like where our money is. I had a press conference with some homeowners who were being foreclosed before Christmas time, and it was really a very powerful experience, because here are first-time home buyers, condos and houses, mostly African-American, Latino, and they had done the right stuff. They'd played by the rules, and they even qualified for fixed-rate mortgages, but they got trapped into these tricked into these exotic mortgages. There were
right.
No time
just bombs. If I could cut in for a second, one of the things we learned was that often the brokers got bigger commissions for the riskier mortgages because there was whatever it was, and they would actually override people's qualifications.
And now their mortgages are time bombs. And so the woman spoke before me. She cried. She started to cry. And I got really angry. And then I learned that the bonus pool, the bonus money and the post-salary compensation that Bank of America is paying could have resolved this foreclosure crisis by itself, could have modified the loans of 2 million people. And so Joy and I decided, my wife and I decided, to take our little Bank of America neighborhood account out and put it in a community bank, a local bank here in D.C., and now others are doing this too. I'm getting calls from pastors and churches and groups of churches, denominations, ordinary people who are saying, and when I'm saying the banks say they're too big to fail, I say let's make them smaller.
And that's one way we can do that, one account at a time. And let me just tell you that I had, not knowing that you were going to bring up that specific issue, I had gotten some information about that I wanted to put out today as as an example. And there's a website called moveyourmoney.info.
Right.
Moveyourmoney.info. And and it is a movement that is taking off. You'll give up the convenience of you know, having an ATM for your particular bank maybe every few blocks, but this is something a little bit of inconvenience. I've often said that I'm afraid our species will die of convenience.
Yeah.
If you look at so many ways, it undermines the quality of our lives. But if people will do this one-to-one, think about it. Talk to your family about it. And as you said, talk to your congregation about it. Talk to the folks in your workplace. Talk to the guys on your softball team. And if we do this, they will have to listen.
Well, the Methodist Church has a $15 billion pension fund by themselves. Now, if they move that, let me tell you, Wall Street will pay attention. So the book lays a foundation for this kind of activity. There are 20 moral exercises at the end of the book, and it's everything from looking at your calendar as a moral document and looking at your life priorities and how your calendar reflects them or not, all the way to moving your money and joining campaigns to hold Wall Street and Washington, D.C. accountable. So I think it's personal, it's family, it's community, but also political. So I think we have a real opportunity here to rethink and reset ourselves, reset our values and directions. And I think if we do that, then we'll be asking the wrong question is, when will the crisis end? Now, we all want to know that, of course. But the better question is, how will the crisis change us? And this book tries to answer, or not just answer, but start a conversation about that question. How will this crisis change us? And how it could really be a kind of a jump start to a national town meeting on how we want to live our lives and, you know, in terms of family values and kids and priorities. And Dr. King talked about a thing culture versus a person-based culture. And that's what we're talking about here.
Oh, and you also, I know, talk about Gandhi's seven deadly social sins.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have those ready at hand, I do.
No, I got them.
Okay. Talk about that just a bit.
Well, Politics Without Principle, this is my next book, I think.
Ah.
Politics Without Principle is one. We've seen some of that. Wealth Without Work, Commerce Without Morality, Education Without Character, Pleasure Without Conscience, Science Without Humanity, and Worship Without Sacrifice. Now, those second and third, Wealth Without Work and Commerce Without Morality, those are diagnostic of where we are right now. Those two really almost describe what we have seen, a casino gambler's economy on Wall Street, and then the contradiction of those who caused this by their behavior are the ones who have suffered the least. Today, again, the bonuses look like they're going to be bigger than last year. And those who had least to do with it are the ones who are suffering the most. So that's a moral contradiction. That's not just an economic equation. That's a moral contradiction. And I think a lot of people, and I'm getting positive response, by the way, from business people and repentant financial people who are really looking at their own hearts and souls and looking in the mirror, even though their companies aren't. So I think this could be a kind of a beyond Republican, Democrat, left-right conversation. My small businessman, husband of my sister, wrote a long letter to the family this week after reading the book, and he's a conservative guy, but he thinks something's gone terribly wrong. The invisible hand of the market, Adam Smith would say, has let go of the common good. And when that happens, we have to regain it back.
Yeah, and for those who aren't familiar with Smith's work, as it's been held up as the, you know, the architecture of what has been going on for the last 30 years in this country and more, he actually severely proscribed and put limits on that free market. And in fact, the book Adam Smith felt was his greatest contribution was not The Wealth of Nations, but a book on moral sentiments.
The one right before The Wealth of Nations.
Yep.
And I talk about that in my book, and it's, you know, he's really saying, it's very interesting. I was started to read Smith beyond just The Wealth of Nations, and he's saying if there's no moral framework for the market, it can't succeed. And Joseph Schumpeter, who was an Austrian economist, hardly a Marxist, Schumpeter says, without ethics and values, the market will devour all the other sectors and finally end up devouring itself.
Wow, that's a description of what's happened.
Yeah, exactly.
And for those who may not have followed this, one of the great shifts in America, we've heard for years that there was a shift going on from a manufacturing society to a service economy, from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, and we saw that happening as plants moved to where there was lower priced labor and so on. But what we weren't watching was that so much of that service sector was not just McDonald's or the monetization of family care and so on. It was larger and larger concentration of our best, our brightest, and our wealth in the financial district, to where it went from, I believe, a norm of about 7% of the economy to where it currently was, I don't know exactly what it is at this moment, but has been over 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just, that goes right back to Gandhi's wealth without work.
Right, exactly.
I'm not saying they're not doing work, but it's not, it has, as many have pointed out, it does not produce things people use, eat, exchange with each other.
Well, in the first chapter of the book, I have this wonderful the conversation with John Stewart and Jim Cramer a few months ago, and it's called Sunday School with John Stewart, because John Stewart basically makes that point. He says there's two economies. There's the one of where people work and produce stuff, and then there's this other economy where we're supposed to put our money and let you guys gamble with our money. And he says, anytime when you say wealth doesn't come from work, you're finally dealing with a lie, and it will come apart and spin out of control, and that's what's happened here. So I was amazed this week. I've just been out with this book for about 3 days, and I was amazed at the depth of, I learned stuff. I had town meetings. I learned a lot of things from people who were talking about what's happened to them in the call-in shows, on an NPR call-in show. You know, poor guy calls an unemployed guy. He has a $15 overdraft.
Oh, my God.
He ends up paying $60 in penalties from his bank for a $15 overdraft. Now, this is the kind of thing that a lot of Americans can relate to. A quarter of their mortgages now are underwater in the country. A quarter of all the mortgages are worth less. The houses were worth less now than the mortgage. So I think that there's a real chance here for, as they say, a teachable moment for a reset. But the news cycle, as long as it's pounding away and panicking about airports and Tiger Woods and what Harry Reid said during the campaign, we're going to miss the real conversation that we ought to have. So it needs to be kind of a guerrilla conversation, or in our local churches and communities and schools, and let's have this conversation whether you know, the networks want to have it or not.
Yeah, I so agree. I've said for years, I think starting about 2004, that unless we have in this country the restoration of democracy, which I think will come from I say three things. One, campaign finance reform, where we have public financing of campaigns. Two, media reform, where we have less concentration, less of this fake objectivity. If there's two sides to a story, you hold them equally. Less of this concentration on tabloid journalism. Somehow do something to restore an informed citizenry. And finally, election reform, where when you vote, you can trust that vote, it will be counted, will be verified, et cetera, that all our other efforts won't really get us where we want to go.
Right, right. Well, this is a chance to have those conversations. When you don't have a crisis, you often can't raise the hard questions. You don't almost have permission to raise fundamental and more basic issues.
Right.
But a crisis gives us that opportunity. And so, again, the worst thing we can do is go back to normal here. And the book is talking about, as I say, what a new normal might look. It's mostly about what we can do, not just how we got here, but how to get out of this, how to reset our values, how we need new habits of the heart. We can't have a green energy or clean energy economy without rewiring not just the grid, but ourselves.
Yeah.
Our habits, our assumptions, our expectations, our lifestyles. We can't have a family matters culture without reprioritizing our relationships with the closest people around us. Thomas Merton, the monk, said it well, that everything finally is about relationships. So I'm already hearing how people are rethinking, you know, their time with their kids. And I've got some great, Little League stories in the book. And then, you know, work itself. We don't just need more jobs. We need more jobs. We also need to look at work itself. What kind of work are we doing? Is it good work, the kind of work that really, is it just flipping burgers, or is it really rebuilding the infrastructure of the society in a new and different kind of way? So, and the service, the ethic of service. I learned a lot of stuff writing this book. One was how 47% of Harvard undergraduates a year before the crisis, 47% wanted to be investment bankers.
Well, Jim, I've been charting that over the last few years, and it's been doubling sort of each year, and it hit its apex just before the crash,
right,
and I believe this year will be different.
Well,
how different will it be?
Here's the other fact, though, that helps to redeem that one, which is I found out that Teach for America now is more competitive to get into than Harvard.
All right.
For young people, it's so competitive now. And here's the deal. They come and work in the worst schools in America, dangerous neighborhoods, hopeless, poor students, and will pay in nothing for it. Now, how could you resist an offer like that? But they're getting more students for that than more competition than Harvard's getting. See, that's the moral landscape now between those two facts.
Yeah, very good. Now, I'm going to have to let you go. But
okay.
But the thing that the challenge that I see, and I sort of maybe would want to talk to you in about 6 months, Jim, is that the disconnect that we cited between Wall Street, the popular media, and I would say a government in Washington too, because for all the good that some intentions some may have, it's clear that the lobbyists are winning. In the healthcare battle, they're winning in the climate battle, they're winning in the Wall Street battle, and the Supreme Court is about to give them even more power, which I'm sure you know about. There's a decision coming down that will take all the limits off corporate financing. How, if all the good people in America get better, but those three institutions, you know, continue in their ways, we're in great trouble. I want to see how we, the people, as we take it on individual by individual, family by family, are able to change those three institutions.
Well, that's I take up the question in the book about how to change politics, not just by replacing one wet-fingered politician with another, has his finger up in the wind and see which way it's blowing, by changing the wind itself. That's now building those movements is the only way to change politics.
Very good. Okay, we've been speaking with Jim Wallace. His newest book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. You can learn more at sojo.net. That's S-O-J-O.net. Thank you, Jim Wallace.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Take care. Bye-bye.